Hi, I'm Freya and I'm the host of Quietly Fascinated. Throughout this series, we'll be chatting to culture creators, tastemakers, storytellers, and some fun characters along the way. I got the idea for this podcast as I was walking down a sunny brownstone street with a little restaurant in the corner. After I'd visited an art gallery and gone to a record store, I wanted to find an audio version to encapsulate that beautiful day. So hopefully this is it for you. To kick off today, we're talking to Amanda Kinsey. She's the founder and CEO of Electric Yoke Media, and she's also a fascinating storyteller. A little more about me, I live in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, originally from London, and I moved to New York City for a job in TV. And I did the normal thing in New York initially of all the cool restaurants, all the hidden bars, all the rooftops. But then I had a baby. And I realized quite quickly that these things I loved about New York City were not going to be serving me anymore. So I found a little mummy group on Facebook. It was 10 years ago. To join locally, called the Baby Hooey. And this isn't really my thing, but I knew I needed to meet some new people that would share this new chapter in my life. And so dreading this mummy meetup, I went along with my stroller once all my family had gone back to England, and I sat next to a really smiley mum with a really cute baby, and we got chatting. And it wasn't just about sleepless nights and diaper genies and which sing-along we were going to. It was interesting and it was fascinating and it was fun. And she made a mummy group that I'm still part of to this day, and it couldn't have been a more different experience than I was expecting. Because Amanda is one of the coolest people I know. And she's here today now. Welcome, Amanda. How's Colorado today?
Colorado is doing well. It's so nice to be on your podcast and such an honor to be your first guest. Thank you for inviting me.
It's my absolute pleasure to have you for a chat. Anytime, but also a recorded chat where we get to talk more in depth about you. You have just had a film released, which I'd love to talk about. And before we dive into that part, I'd love to hear from your own words who you are and what makes you tick.
Sure. So my background, I actually come from a family of storytellers. So my great-grandparents were photographers at the turn of the century, and my grandparents were photographers, and my mother was a photographer, and I kind of went into the combined route of broadcast television early on and out of college and worked for NBC News, and about 10 years ago started my own production company, Electric Yoke Media. And I specialize in content strategy and as well as documentary production. And I love telling stories. That's kind of in my DNA. And the most recent project I just finished is a documentary called Jews of the Wild West. It's the story of Jewish migration to the Western United States from the period about 1840 to 1920. And I just love it because I feel like this story really captures a lot of the ingenuity and creativity and resilience that you find in so many immigrant stories in this country. And it's a uniquely Jewish one, which I think is a really beautiful story as well. And I just found it fascinating. So that is now running on PBS stations across the country and on Amazon. And it's really exciting to see it kind of get its national exposure, and it's been a fun project to work on.
So tell me how you bumped into that story and how you ended up working on it and making it a full feature-length documentary.
So my specialty is really everyday people doing extraordinary things. I did a series for the Today Show for years called American Story, which were essentially mini documentaries, and this documentary kind of taps into that sort of same vein of, you know, some of the people in the documentary are famous, people like Levi Strauss and the Guggenheim family, but most of them you've probably never heard of. But they had a real impact in shaping the Western United States as we know it. And I moved from New York City to Denver about 7 years ago, and I wanted to work on a story that was Wild West specific. I found myself in this place that is really the heart of the Wild West. And I felt like there were a lot of stories that likely hadn't been told but deserved to. We really have a narrow concept oftentimes of our American history. And some of that's because of Hollywood, right? You know, they're the same narratives that kind of get pushed again and again. And the period that the Wild West is sort of defined by historians is the period of the film. So that sort of 1840 to 1920 period. And it's really fascinating because it was such a diverse time period. It's this time where you have all these people coming from all over the world. You have this really rich and in diverse indigenous population as well. And there's a lot happening. And it's a time period that like continues to fascinate people around the world for, I think, various reasons. And I just felt that there were stories that needed to be told. And I came across an archive here in Denver called the Beck Archives of Rocky Mountain Jewish History. And I went down and explored that and was just so impressed by that archive and how much material was there. And no one I knew any of these stories. And that's really how I got started on down this path. And I also discovered really quickly, as I started to trace families that were connected to this period, that there was a generation of family members, usually in their 90s now, that have direct memories of the Jewish pioneers. It's usually their grandparents or great-grandparents. So that's really like the last generation with these, you know, in-person eyewitness accounts. And I thought, well, you know, this is the time to tell it if we're going to tell these stories.
I actually didn't know anything about the Wild West, let alone the Jewish population who helped form it. Can you tell me about the story of the rabbi, which was a lady out of necessity who became the first, was it the first female rabbi during your research?
A non-rabbi rabbi. So yes, there's a woman named Ray Frank, and she was the daughter of Jewish immigrants, and she was raised in Oakland, California. And the way it kind of worked in terms of a religious perspective is that oftentimes you'd have synagogues that would get built in maybe little towns, but you didn't really have enough of a Jewish population to support a full-time rabbi. And so there was a rabbi circuit, and there were talent sort of managers that would book you on the rabbi circuit. And Ray Frank she was a journalist, and then she started out also teaching Hebrew school. And she got herself an agent, and she started getting these gigs on the rabbi circuit. And so she would go around different synagogues throughout the West, primarily the Pacific Northwest, and she would lecture. And she was so sort of interesting and captivating that she also got booked for a lot of non-Jewish groups as well. And she, you know, she spoke a lot about kind of her take on Jewish theology. And I think part of her sort of interest was from, I think, an audience perspective, is she spoke a lot about nature. And of course, you're out in the big Wild West, and it's bigger than anything anyone's ever seen in, you know, parts of Europe, for example, to come out. I mean, it's still, the West is still so jaw-dropping as, you know, in our modern
day. It's incredible. Incredibly big, yeah.
So she really tapped into that and could articulate that in an interesting way from a theological perspective. And, you know, she was Orthodox by background. And so she never, you know, she never wanted to be a rabbi, and she never promoted that women should be rabbis, but she really served that purpose for the most part. So she would, you know, do high holiday sort of things. And, you know, she'd come in and, you know, have kind of that rabbi role. The rabbi role was also different at the time. It was less structured throughout the United States at that time, and certainly different than what would have been, you know, in Europe. And then, you know, the structure of the Wild West like helped that, right? Because there was a need, like they literally needed people to fill this job. And so there was an opportunity for a woman that would not have been there before.
Yeah, it's the pioneer spirit. Which encapsulates why people went there, what they're doing there, and then they just make it work. They made these towns out of nothing. Did you feel pulled to tell that story because also you have ancestors from that time in the Wild West?
You know, it was an interesting story to do. So I am neither Jewish nor Native American, and those are two ethnic groups that are covered in the film, the focus being on the Jewish community. But I feel, you know, I do have family that came out during the California Gold Rush. They have been German immigrants that came out and settled in San Jose and started a tailor shop. And then my great-grandfather later had a saloon in San Francisco. And then my grandparents made their way to Montana and had a photography studio in Butte, Montana. So I have always been fascinated with the Wild West perspective. And then I feel very strongly that storytellers today really do have a obligation to try to help amplify voices that maybe or have been or continue to be marginalized in some way. And, you know, unfortunately, that's a key part of anti-Semitism is often sort of the attempted erasure of Jewish history or Jewish lived experiences. So I felt a really deep obligation to get the story right. You know, I didn't sign on to it until I felt like I really had a market of where I would be able to take this. And so I was aware that there was a Jewish film festival circuit, and I felt like, all right, at a minimum, it would do well there. I had done work for PBS before, so I understood sort of the style for PBS, and I also knew I could do it within a PBS budget, which is a really sort of lean, mean budget, and I knew I could do it that way. But like, you still have to reach like a certain level of broadcast quality. So being able to do that within that budget, I understood exactly what I need to do in terms of that capacity of it. And I was lucky enough, I got invited to present before the film was even close to being finished. I only had a handful of interviews, but I got invited to do a presentation at the Center for Jewish History in New York City, which is a really amazing organization. And I did a little panel discussion and had a couple of the people that I had interviewed at that point come. And we sold out a 250 person theater when there was like a standing room. There was like a standing room only side room with like 30 people. And I didn't even have a film yet. So I felt like that in itself was like the proven concept. I was like, all right, if I could fill a whole auditorium for, you know, 2 hours and I didn't even have a film yet, I felt like, okay, people are going to show up for this. And people did. And I was amazed.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it was incredible. And I, you know, I forget the exact number of donors. I think it's over 100 donors, yourself included, which I really appreciate your support of the film. And, you know, every little dollar counted. And, you know, I would get, you know, small checks, big checks, sometimes from people I knew, oftentimes majority of people who donated, I didn't know. Sometimes I'd met them at a fundraising event, sometimes I hadn't. And I think that was a beautiful thing. I think people really felt like these were important stories that deserved to be told, and it was a piece of history that was going to get forgotten if this didn't happen. And I was really happy that it could help facilitate it. I mean, I think of myself as less of the storyteller of the story and more as like the midwife of it.
I love that analogy.
I'm happy that I was able to do that.
You know, I just think it's so wonderful that these stories have a guardian who will take them through hell or high water to audiences. Because I don't think that telling that story was easy. Even down to, we were talking about the in-depth research you had to do to find the stories. They weren't already necessarily out there, but you dug them up. And it was an important part of piecing this whole documentary together. And that's not the only story you've told. You also worked on the Today Show for a long time as a filmmaker. Could you recall some stories that you remember?
I did a story about two inventors in Cleveland, Ohio, named John Nottingham and John Spurk. And these are inventors who have, at least at the time, close to 500 patents that have made it to market. Things that if you were walking through the drugstore or the supermarket, you would know. So things like the Swiffer, the electric toothbrush, the packaging of like Pepto-Bismol with the little cup on the top.
Wow.
That's all their inventions. The only person in American history to have more inventions would be Thomas Edison, that had actually made it to market. And they took over a really old church that was falling apart in Cleveland, and they turned it into an invention factory. And so we got to go to the invention factory and interview them. They have been really close friends since they were in college. That's how they got started together in design school, and now have had this company for, you know, several decades. And I thought there were kind of two interesting takeaways that they had. One was that there are no new ideas. So we oftentimes, when we think of our own sort of, you know, entrepreneurial ideas or our own narratives, we think about like it has to be so new and different. And if what we're offering isn't new and different, then it maybe doesn't count or it's not worthy of us pursuing. And I love this idea that there are no new ideas, that there are only variations of ideas. And so Nottingham and Spark will come up with something that they think is so brilliant, and then they'll go to the patent office to go file it, and they'll find out that basically the same thing was like invented like 100 years ago, right? Never made it to market, but that it's that idea has been there. And so their point is that there's variations on ideas. And I felt that that's a really liberating concept, that idea that there's variations of ideas and that that can be worthy and that it doesn't have to be so groundbreaking what we do. And I think that's true from the little things in our life to the big challenges we take on, that it doesn't have to, you know, be flying to the moon for the first time to make it count. Another one I did, which I also really love, there was a guy named Joe Addis who was British originally, and he grew up, he had been a child at the end of World War II, and he grew up in the sort of the rubble of Manchester, and right following the war, I think he dropped off, I want to say about third grade education to help support his family. And there were people that were selling things on the street right after the war. And he was lucky enough to sort of become the mentee of some of these kind of iconic guys in Manchester. They were primarily like Jewish peddlers, and he learned how to sell things on the street. And when we caught up with him, he'd been selling potato peelers in Union Station in New York City for decades, and he sold so many of them, he lived in a Park Avenue apartment. And wow. He, like a penthouse apartment, and he would go down. We met him, he was like 74 at the time, and he would go down 6 days a week to sell his potato peelers in Union Square. And I don't know, did you ever run into Joe Addis? He was like remarkable. He looked a little like Sean Connery. He had this like unbelievable, refined British accent to an American ear, though that wasn't really his background because he grew up in poverty. But he'd sit down, he'd have like a bucket turned over, he'd sit on it, he'd have his carrots and his potatoes, and he'd start like peeling in the middle of Union Square. And he had this whole pitch process. He had lines like, you know, buy five and get one free. You know, why do you need four, you know, five potato peelers? Because you have four friends, that's why. And there'd be like 50 people around him, all walks of life, and everybody wanted to buy potato peelers. I remember one person I talked to was like, I don't even eat potatoes, but I'm buying five potato peelers. I don't know why, but I just can't help myself.
So charismatic. And
yeah, he was so charismatic. And his real takeaway was never underestimate a small amount of money. So he really saw the streets of New York City as his bank. So if he wanted, at one point he had like wanted a Rolls Royce. And so that's what he just went out to do, was to like earn money to buy a Rolls Royce. And when we met him, he wanted to put his two granddaughters through college. He wanted them to be able to go to the best college possible, and he wanted to pay for it. And that was what he was going out every day earning money for, was $5 potato peelers. And you have to sell a lot of potato peelers. He'd sold so many of them. They were this, I have it still. There's a special Swiss kind of potato peeler that have like a lifetime guarantee. And he sold so many of them that he had the exclusive distribution rights in the United States from the Swiss company. And they had sent him his own gold potato peeler because he was so good at this.
I want his potato peeler. Yes. I want to know where I get it now. He's in Union Square, do you think?
Well, he passed away a number of years ago, and then his inheritance to his daughter was boxes and boxes of potato peelers. So she would still go out and sell the potato peelers, because that was the life lesson that he wanted to teach her, was that, you know, the street is your bank, and never estimate a small amount of money. And he didn't see, as I mentioned, he didn't see gatekeeping. He didn't see his poverty or his lack of education or the circumstances he'd grown up with as being a hindrance. He just saw that the world was opportunity and it was his to go for it. And it was really interesting. It was like a very interesting take on things. I mean, most of us don't have that, but he really did in a strong, wonderful, charismatic, charming way. And I love that too. So I think the point is that there are a lot of really wonderful lessons to be learned if you just start listening to people's stories, and you have stories as an individual too that are incredible and that they deserve to be told. And that's, you know, I think storytelling in general is a real way of how we connect with one another, how we build empathy. I think that's been part of the human experience really since the beginning. And there's so much noise right now with social media and all the different ways of telling story, but the stories themselves, you know, they don't change all that much, really. If you think about a lot of what, you know, is kind of what makes Shakespeare endure or Greek myths endure, it's very similar to what we still are attracted to today when it comes to, you know, whether it's kind of the little guy overtaking the big guy or love and the drama of that or whatever it is. I think that, you know, we have certain stories that we tend to gravitate universally to. And we all have them, and there's validity in that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to do this, but also one of the reasons I've enjoyed my job and career of working in TV so much is I really like stories. I like the little stories. And actually, you know, if someone had asked me the same question I just asked you of, like, the highlights of when I was working in TV, actually the stories that I've got are not the ones we put on screen. But there are so many characters that you come across, from the grip guy and his family history and his personality to, I remember meeting this woman on a train, and because I'd worked in TV and she'd worked in TV at a certain age, she came out with this life story. Absolutely. How do you think, as your evolution has gone on with storytelling, how do you think motherhood has changed how you have gone about storytelling, or has it changed at all? Or, you know, did that affect what kind of stories you wanted to tell?
The Today Show was a wonderful experience in the sense that the volume of content we were creating on a daily basis, and it's 4 hours of television every single day, was so enormous that you really got a chance to do a little bit of everything. The quality control at the Today Show is really a high priority, which it should be. I mean, that's why it is what it is. But there is a sense of perfectionism that is very ingrained in the culture, that everything has to be perfect. So the lighting has to be perfect, and the sound has to be perfect, and you know, it's got to be edited perfectly.
It's like the opposite of this podcast.
Well, you know, that is a great standard to have, and I think when you are learning and starting your career out, that's a really great gift to be shown that and to have that demanded of you on a daily basis. What I think that the show, frankly, has had to let go of a little bit too, is that's very expensive to do everything perfectly every time, right? And so the show, as I was sort of, you know, wrapping up my career there, was starting to kind of question that a little bit in terms of, you know, they were now having producers shoot video, for example, right? And I can film great with a camera, but I'm not going to compare to some master craftsman cameraman who's been doing that for 20 years, right? And so they were kind of shifting a little bit on that. But it was interesting, when I left the show and started my production company, I had to sort of let go of some of that perfectionism, right? Because I didn't have this entire network behind me. And sometimes I was okay with that. Like I said, I had been shooting things somewhat a little bit myself. And sometimes with my production company, I do film, and sometimes I hire a cameraman. For the longest time, I really had a hang up of, like, editing myself. Like, I felt really intimidated by the editing process, which was so silly because I spent all these years in an editing room working with an editor. So, like, the editorial flow of what I wanted edited, I knew that backwards and forwards, but the technical piece of it, I felt very intimidating. And
me too, by the way. Me too.
Yes. And because you're in it, when you're working in network news, you're also, like, it's very unionized. And so you're not supposed to touch the editing. Like there's different things that kind of, like, contribute to that, right? There's a perfection piece of it. And then there's also, like, the reality, like, they don't want you doing that. And that sort of started to shift when I was leaving, but it was a hard thing for me to sort of get over the perfectionism piece of it. And I feel like what really helped, honestly, was having kids, because it's gone. And I'm not just talking from, like, a professional point of view. I'm talking, like, from a personal point of view. Like, you just can't be perfect in your life. You're not going to be a perfect mother. Your house is not going to be perfect. Your life is not going to be perfect. Your child's not going to be perfect. And you have to really, it's humbling on your knees kind of experience to have a small infant, right? And then you really do have to get over yourself and be like, okay, none of this is going to be perfect, but I'm, like, perfect to my child. My child could care less, right? And I think that's a really important lesson. And so the first job I did coming out of having my first kid was that I worked for Vice and I did a docuseries for Vice. And it was so interesting to be in a professional capacity again because I cared about the product. I wanted the product to be good, but I had really let go of a lot of that perfectionism. It was really interesting. And it was a much more enjoyable experience in production to be like, okay, like we'll make it work. It's going to make it work. It's fine. Like we'll do it. And I think that confidence came from motherhood, and it was interesting and unexpected. I think sometimes you feel like going back into the workforce after having children, you're oftentimes sort of made by society to feel self-conscious, like maybe you don't the same size as you were when before you had a baby, and like everyone's sort of judging you differently because you have a baby, and everyone's assuming that you're going to be scatterbrained or not be able to do things right or whatever. But I actually feel like I came into that work environment with a greater maturity and an ability to be like choosing my battles, going with the flow, and understanding like at the end of the day, like sometimes good enough is fine, right? And that's okay. And I feel like I was like a kinder kind of manager in that sense too, right? Because I had just been taught all the time that it had to always be perfect, 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 perfect. And that's not really a very fair thing to demand of people. So I think that was an interesting shift for me to work at Vice and have be now a mother and have still, I went back after a year of maternity leave and just realized, oh, wow, like I am sort of different. Like I look at this a little bit differently. And I think that was probably one of the bigger sort of shifts and changes for me.
Yeah. I also like, you know, when you're bringing up these little people, you never expect them to be perfect. You're trying to teach them and you're saying, it's okay. I have one of my daughters has severe perfectionism at an early age. And I'm always like, it doesn't matter. It's a progress. You know, just keep trying. And then you realize you're not doing that for yourself professionally. And then you realize that you can talk to yourself the way you talk to your kids. And that's kind of an amazing thing of being a mother as well, where you're like, I'm trying to be super kind to everyone. And as you said, a nicer manager in a lot of ways. Yeah. I think when I started in media, trying to get to the top was a big scramble. And now it's more of a, I understand the process and sometimes you're still and it ebbs and flows. And that's a great life lesson. And just being the day. Yeah.
And you see the bigger picture in a different capacity, I think. And I feel like you know, even having a year where I wasn't in the midst of that, like having a maternity leave, having a kind of a mental break from that, also it gives you fresh perspective, right? Well, I would never have had that otherwise. So I think, I think there are real advantages to that. It's so interesting though, because you still like, you know, you don't put motherhood on your resume usually, right? And that is a huge piece of who we now are and how we look at things. And I think is an added value, but that's not, I see that, you see that. I don't know that the world necessarily sees that, which is always kind of unfortunate, but
Not yet, but I do feel like having had a child, you do see the world in a more mature way because you have to take care of other lives. Well, you've done a lot of work on yourself to be the best parent you can be. And that's like an amazing resource in the office. I'd love to ask you, if you had a dream project that you could do, you're such an interesting person, you've had such an interesting life, if you had any idea you could run with, what would it be? And maybe someone listening will throw you a load of cash to do it.
Yeah, you didn't have to throw it out there. You know, my focus has always been nonfiction, and I'm just sort of at the beginning process of a fiction project that I'm working on. And that's an interesting kind of stretch too. So, you know, I think to me, like I'm always interested in how storytelling is evolving. I'm always interested in sort of growing my own brain and my own experience. Like I find the intellectual challenges of whatever is sort of new to be what keeps me hooked. You know, that was the part of sort of the NBC part is that it didn't, you know, it was frustrating. It didn't evolve, right? It was broadcast news and this is what I was going to do. And it just really just wasn't going to go anywhere other than where it was going. And there's so much in storytelling that has shifted in terms of how we tell stories, how we distribute stories, what stories get told. Some of that has really dramatically shifted in the past, you know, 15 years, especially. And so I'm always looking for, like, where are those kind of new, interesting opportunities? You know, I think it's interesting when we look at, for example, you know, there's so much emphasis placed on social media, and yet there is this emergence right now of, like, trying to create, like, immersive experiences for people. You think, like, the Sphere in Las Vegas is, like, this idea of, like, going into a space, and, like, people are craving that. Like, I haven't been, no. Yeah, I do, because I kind of want to see this technology and how it, like, what is being done with it, what the limitations are, and then, like, where could it be pushed? Like, where could you go next on it?
It really freaks me out. I feel like I'm living in the future when I see
people. Have you been on it?
I haven't. You know, yeah, a lot of people from my old office, they actually did an advert for a show I used to work on, in the Sphere.
Yeah.
And they all went on, and I just, like, I feel like I'm sitting at home watching the future from where I used to be. Like, we used to put ads on TV on billboards, and now they're at the Sphere doing it. It's really wild. I would like to experience it, but it is.
Yeah, but it's really, I mean, it's also fascinating. There used to be this great conference that this doesn't exist as a conference anymore, but it exists as a sort of a concept, I guess. Still called the Future of Storytelling. And there's a guy named Charlie Melcher in New York who comes from publishing, and he would put this conference on it was over in Governor's Island, and I went a few different years while it was running. And it was interesting. He'd bring together creatives, so I was, like, in the creative bucket, and then he'd bring together advertising executives, and then he'd bring together, like, technologists, like, people that were really, like, pushing the edge of technology. And the first time I went was about 10 years ago, and I remember there's a woman named, I'm forgetting her name. I'm forgetting her name. I think it's Noni Pena, I think is her name, out of USC. And she does AI. And 10 years ago, we were sitting there, they had a demonstration, they were going in and they were interviewing Holocaust survivors, you know, because that generation, you know, is now kind of dwindling. And they were interviewing them, and they were applying AI to it so that they, in the future, could bring those AI interviews into schools. And the AI component of it was they appeared sort of like holograms, but you could ask them questions. So, which was wild. So you could ask, you know, this guy that was not really sitting on the set, you know, any question really, and he potentially could answer it. And we're talking so much about AI, you know, in 2024, but this was 10 years ago, yeah. Noni had developed this. And so that conference is really neat because you were seeing all this, like, sort of cutting edge stuff. And in the creative bucket of people was also really interesting because there's this whole kind of class of, like, immersive artists, which are fascinating. I have a friend from that, Emily Baltz, who does, like, food experiences. So she will come into... She has one where, like, you eat, like, cotton candy, and as you're eating cotton candy or ice cream, anytime you, like, lick it, it makes, like, an instrument sound. Like, I don't even know how that is possible, but she does it. And she gets flown all these places, like Dubai and all this stuff, to do these, like, immersive food experiences. It's so out there and crazy and amazing, but there is, like, a market for that, and there is this sort of, like, cutting-edge storytelling that's happening with it. Emily and I did a project together where... we worked for BASF, which is a giant German chemical company. It's been around forever. And they were doing an innovative a conference that was focused on innovation. And they wanted to kind of be seen as hip and cool. And so she had these glass houses built, three glass houses. It's like small houses. And my job was to come up with the film content that they were going to project into the houses. And the film content had to be within the realm of what were the conference sort of themes, but also had to be food related. So that was kind of her thing. And so we did. Yeah. And so we did there was a winery in Red Hook that had gotten wiped out with Hurricane Sandy, and they had rebuilt. And so that we did that for the theme of resilience.
I love that winery, by the way.
Yes. So they had to rebuild everything.
New York, yeah.
And then we did, there's a really wonderful nonprofit called Hot Bread Kitchen up in Harlem that trains new immigrants from all over the world into the culinary arts and then gets them into, like, schools. Hot Bread Kitchen. It doesn't get them into schools, I'm sorry. Gets them into high-end kitchens all over New York City. So Hot Bread Kitchen is really cool. And we did that about, I think it was not immigration, but it was the theme... I think it was like adaptation or something like that. So we did that for that piece of it. And then They had another piece of it that we focused on. There's gardens in Battery Park that like our vegetable gardens, but when they started them at this period, like when we were doing the filming, was the first time since the Dutch that any agriculture had been built, had been like grown in Battery Park.
Oh, wow.
Which is crazy, right? So we were doing it about that. So it was that was about habitat. So we were I think there probably is. I mean, it was pretty popular. It was like right when you entered Battery Park on the west side. And they would have school groups come down.
So nice now.
It's so nice. I know. This was a nice part of them. Yeah. I mean, it's so anyway, we did that. We projected it through into these little houses, and then people could eat the vegetables from the garden and have the wine and have the bread. And it was like, so it was this like multi-sensory experience. Anyway, I mentioned that because I think it's so fascinating. Like, what a way to tell a story. Like, how different is that than just sitting and being like a passive observer of something? And I love anything that's sort of like pushing the boundaries of that. So I find that really interesting as well. So I think in terms of projects, like I'm always sort of interested in what is next and how do I get involved with that? And how do I push myself in a creative way that sort of plays on my skill set, but is also like pushing me to grow? And that's what I really love about this profession, right? Because there is sort of no end to that.
If I could have a dream project, finances aside, I really want to catalog my own family history. You know how people used to do oral histories? My family are really spread out across the globe, but they have some really interesting tales to tell. My father's from India, and you know, my mother's from Ireland, so they had some tales of how they got there. And this time next year, is there anything you ideally would like to do during the year, or would have liked to?
It's such a good question.
That can be so light. It doesn't.
Yeah, it can be so light. You know, last summer we were lucky enough. We went to Hawaii, and I dream about dying daily. I just want to be back in Hawaii. I was lucky enough when I was a kid. We lived in Hawaii for a year, which was really special and really fun. And
where did you live?
We lived in Honolulu at the bottom of Diamond Head, which was awesome. And there is something about that place that is so unique. And I hadn't been there in years and years until last summer. And you get off the plane, and that the smell and the warm breeze and the whole thing, it just really was nostalgic, and I loved it. So I'd like to figure out something I could just go do in Hawaii. That would be really fun. I used to, when I was at the Today Show, I used to come up with like places I wanted to go visit, and then we'd come up with stories that we could like try to sell the show on. So I did get to, you know, places like Alaska that way and stuff like that. I never got to Hawaii. My sister, who at the time was working for BuzzFeed, she got herself to Hawaii. She went and did a story about a surfing pig, and she got to Hawaii. I was very jealous. I should have come up with that for the Today Show, but she beat me to it with BuzzFeed.
This time next year, I really want to do a French cooking class. I've never done one.
Oh, nice.
I've always wanted to do one. But
yeah, you should. In France or here?
I mean, ideally in France. I think I said that happens in France, trying to like entice you to come do it with me.
But absolutely. I feel like we should take this podcast on the road. I think we got to go to the Sphere. And then we got to go to Paris.
I'm quietly fascinated everywhere. So
absolutely. I mean, you really could be quietly fascinated everywhere, and you got to, it's a proof, you know, concept, and you got to go out and do it.
Amanda, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
It was the most fascinating chat. Next time, hopefully we have some more wine.
Yes.
And I hope to see you soon, and thank you for being my first podcast guest.
Oh, it's my honor. Best of luck. I can't wait to hear the future ones.